All right, Shisha, so let's see if any of these apply to you, okay? You've done the therapy, you've read the books, but you have yet to dip your toe into the somatic healing pond. You still find yourself having reactions that are out of proportion to the situation at hand. You live in a constant low-grade state of hypervigilance, like you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. Or you're on the opposite end, you're checked out, disconnected, floating through life like your head is a completely separate entity from the rest of your body. You live in chronic tension, your shoulders are up to your ears like mine, or your jaws clenched, hips tight, lower back pain. Or you deal with digestive issues, or you're constantly tired in a way that sleep just doesn't seem to fix. And last but not least, you're craving a place to heal with other cool people where you can just show up as your whole messy self and be accepted for it. So if any of those applied to you, and let's get real, shit shows, at least one of those applied to you, it's time that you sign the hell up for Breathe to Heal. This 7-week journey kicks off on Tuesday, January 13th. It's led by Teresa, fellow Shit Show member and somatic and breathwork practitioner, and it combines the 3 modalities that literally helped me thaw out of functional freeze and start moving my life in the direction I actually wanted. Breath work, somatic practices, and parts work. This is a steal compared to other somatic programs out there with 2 and 3 month payment options to make it more accessible. So yes, you, let's do the damn thing already. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is breathe with an E at the end, adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal to get your damn spot and thank me later. You cannot heal if you keep pretending it doesn't hurt. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. What you're holding on to, just let it all go. What's making you slow now, just let it all go. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea, and I am a total and complete shit show and the captain of this hot mess of a healing ship. So today, folks, we are diving deep with Andy Carlson. He is the co-host of the podcast Time with Tim Fletcher. So he is the right-hand man of Mr. Tim Fletcher, someone that we all know and love, and you're going to love Andy just as much. He's a trauma coach. He is a facilitator in Tim's trauma online healing program called Lift. And he is bringing a wealth of knowledge to the table, both lived experience and his experience in helping others. So Andy grew up in a hyper-controlled religious household where children were not to be seen or heard, were like actually making noise, having needs, or just like being a kid was not cool. And that kind of rigid control taught him to disappear into himself, to go numb into his body, and to just live in the chaos of his head. And so in last week's episode on How the Body Keeps the Score, I talked about how this stored survival energy that gets trapped inside of us causes us to live in this low-grade, constant survival state, and how that can go in one of two directions. The first being the hyper-vigilant, always waiting for the other shoe to drop route, which is definitely the space that I went. While Andy, he took the other route. He went the more numb, disconnected route. And so we are going to be diving into that a lot. He brings a ton of somatic knowledge to the table. So after we get through his story, we spend a large portion of the episode diving into his journey back into his body, as well as just various somatic practices that he uses personally and also uses in his work with others. So yeah, this is kind of a bridge episode. So we're going to be diving into a lot of somatic stuff today with Andy. And then next week, we will be talking more somatic healing as well. So this episode has something for everyone. If you grew up in a hyper-controlled or a highly religious household, if you ever felt like you had to be perfect to be worthy, if you ever found yourself trapped in a miserable and unhealthy relationship that you just can't seem to get out of, if you've had to grieve family members that are still alive, this episode is for you. So let's just get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the join shit show, my online support community where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. We have 6 weekly Zoom support groups
We have an app that is basically like a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket. We have a 24/7 hour chat that's available to you. We have over 20 sub communities that are based off different interests or struggles, like shit show parenting, healing from narcissists, shit show dudes, neurodivergent issues, divorce and separation, childhood sexual abuse survivors, sober support, food struggles, you name it, we got it. This is relational trauma, folks. We heal relational trauma through safe relationships, and this is the place where you can do so for less than a damn dollar a day. So you, yes, you, yeah, you, let's do it already and hop aboard this damn healing ship. Get off that shame dinghy you're on and hop aboard this healing ship. We are waiting for you. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, or you can see the link in the show notes next. Give me a follow on Insta and TikTok at adultchildpod. Last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. Mr. Andy Carlson, not to be confused with Andy. No one's ever called you Andy, right?
Not in the United States, no.
Okay. Welcome. Now I get to do the question asking.
I'm glad to hear you speak, and I'm glad to be here as well.
How long have you been working with Tim?
So 3 years ago, at this time 3 years ago, I was going through his LIFT program, which is a 75-day trauma healing program. And after that, they invited me to do their COMPASS training it's the training to be a coach and a facilititator. And then, like, I never had any intention of being a trauma coach and facilitator. I just wanted to heal myself and get back to the world. And after I graduated from COMPASS, I started facilitating and coaching for them. And I had a little detour. I spent 6 months at an addiction center, working at an addiction center in Costa Rica that uses Tim's materials. And then back.
What's it called?
Yeah, it's the Monkey Farm. It's near Playa del Coco on the Pacific side. And so I have an affinity for Costa Rica. And so being by the jungle and the ocean and living in community was really special.
The Monkey Farm. That's perfect.
Yeah. There's about like 15 guys there at any one time. Most of them recovering alcoholics, some other drug use. Like, Costa Ricans are good humans all around, and these guys were just really good humans as well.
So what is it? Is it implementing the LIFT program, or like what about it makes it different than your typical recovery center?
Yeah, it is. That's the main thing, is it's implementing the LIFT program. And I think one of the things that's different about the LIFT program is a lot of recovery work has so many things that they do right. A lot of them stop beneath the layer of shame. Mm-hmm. And so it may still be like, I was in the problem, or this was a problem. And that's still a little bit of a shaming layer, where we recognize that alcohol and our trauma patterns they're the symptom, they're a Band-Aid, and not the actual problem itself. And the actual problem itself is the underlying complex trauma and the shame that leads our life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's interesting for me how much differently like the AA 12 steps hit for me now as opposed to how they did when I first got sober. And I mean, it saved my life, you know, AA saved my life. But, you know, when all of my childhood stuff came to the surface, it's just amazing how I was even thinking about this, about how like the focus on like being of service is obviously like part of what keeps one sober, and it's helpful and it's useful. But for people with complex trauma, there's this ingrained messaging in 12-step recovery that's like, you never say no, you know, unless you have a reason to. And it's like, for a lot of people who grew up in dysfunctional homes and who still have this complex trauma in them, it's actually like learning how to say no. And so I feel mm-hmm. like kind of working the program in a way can keep you trapped in a lot of those trauma responses.
And I would say, especially around the service component too, is a lot of us come in with codependence. And so there is that difficulty of saying no. And so I would go the other way, is it's like, we have to learn how to say no. And unless your body is absolutely screaming yes, then give your body permission to say no. Because so many of us have come from a background where we're forced into roles, forced into caretaking, forced into that codependence. And it's like a part of us, and we have to learn how to respect and develop our own agency first. Can I detour for a second?
Go for it.
We talked about, you mentioned IFS a little bit ago. And I think the way I look at service for me is having done parts work, really the reparenting part of the parts work, is I'm learning how to love myself deeper. I'm learning how to integrate these parts of myself in a deeper way. And so I kind of look at all of my interactions. So like my interaction of you, if I have like some negative reaction to what's going on, I recognize that negative reaction as being a part of me. And then when I do that reparenting, if I can offer that curiosity, that kindness, that compassion to it, that allows me to love myself deeper, but it allows me to love you as well. And so I see you as this, I'm loving you, but I'm loving you by learning how to love myself. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
And I see service that same way as well. It's like I'm doing service as an act of love to myself rather than this need to, or because somebody's telling me to, or because there's a rule to do it. And so my coaching and my facilitating, don't tell my clients, it's about me. It's about me loving myself better and allowing that to be shared with other people rather than trying to help or to fix anybody or to change anything.
Well, I guess that's what it kind of really is too with like in 12-step recovery, right? It's like by helping other people get sober, like it's helping you to stay sober. But I don't know. I just think it can be a little bit overboard. Okay, so let's back up here. And my first question that I ask anybody is, when was the moment that you realized that your childhood screwed you up more than you thought?
I'm a really slow learner. And I would say it was probably about a year before I found Tim Fletcher's program is when
Four
years ago. I was in a marriage, a really difficult and painful marriage, and had been quote unquote treatment resistant depression for probably the last 6 years of that. But that was more of just, not being allowed to be alive inside that relationship. And as a hyper codependent, I spent a lot of time looking for psychology stuff. And it was really that year, 4 years ago, that I found complex trauma for the first time and really started to understand complex trauma and to see just the depth and the severity of the childhood. I think part of the reason I was slower than most is I came from this very narcissistic Christian isolationist family. And so we had this like small world view and extreme loyalty. And it was also just very unified in that we were great and people with problems were bad or stupid or dumb or out of control. And so we were very much like blame the victim, blame people, hate and reject everybody rather than just starting to find the truth of our humanity and behind it. And so I think it took me a while to unwind from all of that.
Well, you were taught to constantly, it's interesting because I just had this as a topic for my group, for my community the other day about accountability and how it either goes one of two ways, right? Like we either take on the blame for everything or we have a complete inability to look at ourselves as a way to block out the shame. So what it sounds like from your upbringing, it's just like no self-reflection.
No self-reflection. And you also just, you really distrust everybody else. You kind of hate the world. And so you don't get a lot of feedback when you're keeping yourself isolated, rigid, and at a distance from everybody. It's a very easy way to stay on one track.
Do you remember how you found, you stumbled upon complex trauma?
I was working at a Buddhist retreat center as their retreat manager. And there was somebody there who, when most of the other volunteers ran into her, they survived 2 days to 2 weeks. I was, again, slow enough that I survived 2 months. And it was just, there's like, I was in a deep amount of pain with my relationship. And then all of a sudden, here's this other person that's creating a deep amount of pain. The weird thing is the woman who is the director of the center reminded me of my mom. Like she was my mom. If my mom had grown up in a wealthy family in San Francisco and had a good life, but she had all the characteristics of that codependence. as well. And so I saw this kind of like narcissistic figure controlling everything, this codependent, washing everything else clean. And in the, you know, the pain and the kind of the strangulation that was going on inside me at that time and just the spinning, I discovered Pete Walker, who wrote a really great book about CPTSD. And, you know, I'd run across like Russell Vanderkalk before, like The Body Keeps the Score. So I understood PTSD, but had never really hit the PTSD, this complex trauma side of it.
And was that like a tough pill for you to swallow?
You know, it was a slow pill for me to swallow because, you know, I think one of the things with complex trauma, and it's something our society does well, even like our language in society, is you made me angry. There's a lot of projection, a lot of blame. And so it's very easy for us. There's this like weird thing that we can do where we can like split our pain. And if I demonize you, if I make you the bad person, then I can almost like, I don't have to feel that pain. I can just project it onto somebody else. I can project it onto the other. And so at that time, I was still in that place where I was, you know, I demonized the woman who was being really painful rather than recognizing the truth of the pain that was alive and inside of me. And so it took me a while. Like it took me a while to kind of like fully realize, you know, that personal responsibility, that accountability is something that I think it's still shifting and growing inside of me today, rather than having that default split of you made me angry, you did this, and just, you know, really, really internalizing and owning everything.
How would you have described your childhood prior to that?
You know, I would describe my childhood in general as good family, good parents. We always sat at front of church. You know, my dad was the disciplinarian in the school. That wasn't his assigned role, but that's the role he took on. And so there was, like, I grew up in this system where everybody was beneath us and everybody was bad. But I also knew, you know, there was always still this deep fear. But again, splitting from that deep fear of like my own shame, my own badness, and a lot of this torment that was inside. And so there was always like places where there was something off.
I was going to ask what role you were.
I was, you know, it's a weird, I can't think of the role. I was like the scapegoat, the invisible child. Like I had more of my mother's body. And so like my brother and sister didn't. And so like my dad would body shame me. Like I had, my mom sleeps less than the family. I, as a child, slept less than the family. And so like I was yelled at and screamed at by dad for not being asleep in bed. And so like I was like different for some different reasons, but I was also like, there's a lot of things like turned me into the scapegoat in my family. And so I had a little bit of awareness of that, but also this deep loyalty to, you know, in a shame world, your family, like if you're not all good, that means they're all bad. Yeah. And so when somebody's abusing you that loves you, if you think one thing wrong about them, that means they're demonizing them. And so you have to suppress, hide from, and brush away all that. So there was a lot of internal conflict, but that conflict was really deeply suppressed inside of me.
What was the relationship like, dynamics between your parents?
My dad was God and my mom was the one who made him God. Like my mom she's the one who taught me to be a really great codependent, to be extremely sacrificial, to hide myself, to be not seen, and to make the other person, put the other person on a pedestal and make that other person great. And so my mom, through her own complex trauma and shame, has like really elevated my father. There was never any, you know, I think part of the thing that made it difficult for me is there's never any disunity between them. And so even if he did something that was too extreme for her, she supported him because as a part of her role, she had to be 100% on his side no matter what.
That's interesting. And then what about the dynamics with your siblings?
Yeah, you know, it's sad. I have a memory of being about 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old. My sister's a year older than me, and my brother is 2 years younger. and it's springtime in Minnesota. The snow has been melting. There's some puddles, and we find this little, almost little ditch in the wood behind our house, and just playing with them for hours, imagining it's like a pirate ship, imagining all sorts of things, that it's a lake, we're in this lake, and we're just playing, we're having fun. And because we were wet when we came in, we got screamed at, yelled at, spanked. That's the last time I remember having fun with my siblings. And there's this extreme disconnection with us, because connection requires aliveness, and aliveness requires movement and noise. And movement and noise are dysregulating to my father. And so if you have movement and noise, you're yelled at, you're screamed at, you're punished. And so we just learned to be very disconnected. By the time when my sister was a senior in high school and I was a junior, we might have spoke to each other 15 minutes over that entire year. We just existed in the same place with each other, but we didn't have a relationship with each other. And there's like lots of other layers of dynamics, but there's...
Was it just the two of you? Or how many siblings do you have?
Younger brother, older sister. Okay. And we're all within 4 years of age.
Did your parents pit you guys against each other?
Yeah, my siblings love to tattle. Like, tattling was rewarded. And so it was like definitely like there was this competition of punishment, badness. You know, I couldn't say the word pee. You know, if you said pee or piss, your mouth was washed out with soap. We could say piddle and putter, but the word fart was a dirty word. Pee was a dirty word. And so like there's a lot of things, like there's, you know, a list of rules 10,000 lines long, and if you're a human being, you're going to run into those rules 100 times a day. And so there was a lot of fodder for us to tell on each other, and then you get the other person punished.
Well, they would be very offended by my podcast then. Not like we're using a lot of bathroom humor, but we're saying fuck a lot.
No. Well, So I have no fear of my family ever hearing this, because...
Because again, you know, I do put the explicit rating, so...
Yeah. And so I just think it was like, it was a place where aliveness was punished. Obedience was next to godliness. And... You know, children are supposed to be alive and free. And that was just something that wasn't allowed. And I think it shows up in the rigidity and the distance in our relationships, and that just this fear of connection, because connection leads to punishment. And so how can you have a real relationship and not have a fake relationship if you're not allowed to connect?
Were you guys... Did they have siblings or grandparents? Like, did you have other family that was around? And was that, I mean, were you guys kind of closed off from that as well?
I have like two funny stories about that. We lived about 2 hours from each of our grandparents. And they were about...
Where did you grow up? In Minnesota?
I grew up in a small town in Minnesota named Sabika. There's 600 people there.
Wow.
It was a place where my father could feel big in a small place. And it was also, ironically, I think he was, you know, we hated white trash growing up. White trash, white trash, white trash, a lot of disgust, a lot of, you know, shame and just some venom directed in that way. And I'm in my mid-40s right now. It was maybe 10 years ago. No, it was within the last 5 years ago on my healing journey. What I realized is like the family that my dad came from. When you go out into the extended family, like we were that white trash.
Yeah, I was going to ask that he what hated. You thought it stemmed there, from.
Yeah. And there was, we were distant from his family. And I think it was part of his way of kind of finding safety and separation from a lot of alcoholism, a lot of domestic violence among his uncles and relatives. And then my mother's mom was a very strong-willed woman. And so he had two opportunities of where to get a job when they were just starting out. And one was near her family. And he was scared of being, you know, gamers are afraid of game, basically. And so he took the other job that kept us like really far from her family as well. And so we basically just saw relatives on holidays. And so our family was like really isolated. We were the family that did the neighborhood picnic in the summer. And when I was really young, my parents maybe once or twice a year had some teachers over, but there were no other humans that were inside our house other than relatives. And that might only be once or twice a year. Like we never had guests, we never had friends over. It was just like a very isolated
Did you
place.
have friends? Like, would you have play dates with friends or hang out with people?
Yes and no, the limit of who I could have. So again, if you're comfortable saying the words pee or fart, you're a bad person and I can't be around you. If you drink or smoke or swear or say things about women or, whatever, say something off color, you're a bad person. And there's this like fear of contagion almost. There's a leprosy to the reality of humanity. And so the friends that I could have were the straight A students and also like so smart kids who came from quote unquote good Christian families, like other people who were generally more rigid and controlled. And so I had a weird relationship with my school. My dad was a teacher in the school and he loved to punish people. And so coming from a small town, elementary was a little bit safe, but once in 7th grade, if my dad's bullying kids, they can't bully him back. And so they have to bully me. So I had a very much, it was not a love-hate relationship with my town. It was a hate relationship with my town. And it was part of it was justified because of all the venom that was directed at me, but that was just them redirecting. It was weird. At home, he was the ruler and the abuser, and then at school, he was a ruler and abuser towards others, and then so they kind of directed it at me. So there was no safe place and not a lot of people who really cared to be my friend either.
Did you have that awareness when you were a kid that this is retaliation of what my dad is doing to them, or that's something that came later on in life?
That's something that's come, like thinking of retaliation. So like the projecting badness onto everybody really protected me back then, but it also protected him from me seeing the truth. And so it was just easy, kids who were name calling or abusive to me, they were bad kids. They were like, obviously they deserved punishment or whatever they got. And so there was just no knowledge or awareness of it at that time. Like I was blinded. I look at my early life and my early career as essentially being living out my father's fever dream. And really, it took a while to start to find my own path. And I think, fortunately and unfortunately, like hitting rock bottom and being at rock bottom for 8 years to the degree of the system that I came in, you kind of need to hit your head against the ground to learn that you need to move in a different way. And some of us need to hit our heads against the ground for a
Quite a
lot
while.
longer
Well, I
than
mean, the
others.
blinders were so deep, thick, you know?
The use of blinder. Like I look at it as like I lived underneath this veil of oppression, this veil of belief, and there was no point where I'd ever even really gotten glimpses outside of that veil. And so it took a while and it took a lot of painful experiences to start to grow and to change and to move into normal humanhood, even by the tiny degrees that I did in my 20s and 30s.
And so, was it kind of like a slow build? Because you talk about, getting to this place of depression within your marriage, but was it a kind of like a gradual uptick in seeing the ways in which your childhood was impacting your life as an adult, or was it kind of always a struggle?
No, I think where it was always a struggle. Like there's always this like deep shame, deep insecurity, deep anxiety, lots of neuroticism. The one way I was able to channel it was by, OCD and smartness. And so I could get, the only time I was ever appreciated was by having good grades. And so being good and doing well in that way. And so, yeah, it was, I don't think like not understanding how complex trauma creates that anxiety, creates that insecurity. It's just like anxiety is a problem inside of me. It's no awareness that that came from my family or my family system or the lack of regulation from never feeling safe in childhood. And so it was just something where like I'm just like bouncing along in this hyper anxious mindset, trying to run really hard to make a lot of money and have prestigious careers to finally someday be loved. It was like I was living out a salvation fantasy, basically. If I make it big, I'll be safe and I'll be loved. If I'm wealthy, I can finally be safe and I can be loved. And my like 20s and 30s, like those were the blinders in my 20s and 30s, was this deep insecurity just driving me really hard toward these goals that one day maybe I'd feel okay, but not knowing why. There's no cognizance of what was going on in the present moment or why throughout all of that.
And do you feel like getting married brought more things up to the surface? Because, I mean, obviously we talk about, you know, big things like that. I mean, obviously it's relationships and having kids. Do you think that it was just that brought more things up, more was revealed, or it was just a result of the dynamics of the relationship?
You know, I think I'm really fortunate in a way that my wife also came from a family of extreme trauma, but in
a very different, of course she would have.
In a very like different vein. We were almost opposites. I think I would have had difficulty in any relationship because of the extreme codependence, the fawning, but also the rigidity and needing to look good and fear of badness. Our marriage was like particularly suited for giving me those 8 years of pain. And so, and I'll just, you know, I still like, I'm finding the language to talk about it still. Uh-huh. Because there's layers of my healing. You know, while I was in it, she was a problem. Afterwards, there's a recognition of, you know, we both had our trauma. And from a place of extreme responsibility and recognizing, you know, healthiness and red flags in others, a healthy person would have never entered that relationship. And so, like, I have these, like, different layers that I look at it. But just to give a sense, her first childhood memory is walking into a living room and her mom is being choked by her current boyfriend, and 3-year-old her pushes the boyfriend away. She's thrown across the room. Mom, boyfriend leaves, mom goes to the hospital, leaves her in a closet, and then this boyfriend comes back with like a knife or a gun. And so her first memory is this extreme trauma. And so what would happen in our relationship is like you could tell the switch. There was this first 6 months where it was the best relationship I was ever in. She was bold. She was brave. She was just alive. And we were such a great combination together. We finished each other's sentences. We played. I can look back now and I see a lot of that was two things. One was like oxytocin, just that oxy rushing through me. And then another being her own trauma of fawning. And so we'd finish each other's sentences, but I'll give you a good example. What's your favorite food, Andrea?
Pizza.
Oh my gosh, Andrea, me too. I love pizza so much. We should get pizza together tonight. What's your favorite music?
My favorite artist is Billy Joel. Let me guess, you love Billy Joel too?
He was just on the radio yesterday, like Piano Man. Oh, wow. Like, can you imagine, like, we have so much in common. Like, this is so beautiful. Like, I'm so glad that we're able to connect here. Like, so there was a switch that flipped from that until like the day after we got engaged. And once I passed this intimacy threshold with her, all of a sudden, she no longer, like, she loved my
cooking.
She
hated pizza.
She no longer liked my cooking. Yeah, yeah. I never liked pizza. I don't like that music. And so, but like, you know, coming from this, you know, hyper Christian religious family, I'm on this path and I've just made a public pact. And all of a sudden, there's these like really kind of crazy things happening, and I'm responsible for trying to regulate her emotions. I'm responsible, you know, in that, in her being triggered by intimacy, there was always this sense that whereas my dad was like, from this top down, you are bad, her response was, you're abusing me. And so if I said I love you the wrong way, I was screamed at and yelled at for 4 hours. But in a sense of like, and there's nothing I could say, nothing I could explain. And I didn't have boundaries. I came from an enmeshed family, and so I'm enmeshed with her. And so when she's dysregulated, I'm dysregulated. And I also came from this place of extreme badness and fear of being bad. And so every time, like if I said, I love you the wrong way, you're beautiful the wrong way, if I was looking in the junk drawer for something, something would trigger her. And that trigger was always like put onto me as I was like, I said, I love you the wrong way once. And it was as if I'd curb stomped her. Like that was the result. And I didn't know how to walk away. I didn't know how to move away. I didn't know how to take care of myself. As a good codependent, when I'd think of something that was healthy to do, I'd offer it to her. So massages and vacations and breaks, like I stayed home because we couldn't afford to, but I like gave that to her. And you know, there's a point where that happening every other day, the only safe place for me was depression, was really like dying inside. I forget your original question. I think I went off track there.
No, I think that was perfect. So, I mean, was there a little bit of, well, first of all, it sounds like crazy making, right? Was there some Stockholm syndrome there? Like, was there ever a part of you that started to believe that you were the problem? And it's interesting because you say that, you know, coming from a home where it's like, they're the problem, it's, you know, no ability to self-reflect, but you're in that dynamic. And I'm assuming that you kept it in?
I did. Like, you know, the sad thing is throughout all this, I talked to my mom about it. It took me a long time to finally talk to my mom. And that was, there was actually that point where I was ready. Like, I knew I had to end the marriage. But I also knew my family, divorce, evil, sinner, bad. The few people who were divorced in our family were looked down
horrible
on as second class citizens, horrible. And so I went to my mom and kind of laid everything out, kind of how I was like this Atlassian, like carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders, and brought up like, I think I need to end the marriage. Like this is where the shift of like, I had to go to my mom to ask permission to end my marriage. And that's like, that shows my own lack of agency, my own lack of will, you know, my own codependence and, you know, self erasure. And when I did ask that after, you know, she knew for a while what was going on, and I was like, I need to end the marriage. The only words out of her mouth were the perfect codependent, try harder. And it was actually at that point where depression really became the only option. Because I was so exhausted and so beat
and trapped.
And, you know, as you and trapped. Yeah. And with what you said, too, there is this, you know, I was made responsible for my dad's nervous system dysregulation as a child. And so, if you sniffle your nose, he starts yelling at you. If you chew too loudly, he stops yelling at you. You might get hit. You might get thrown away from the table. Your food security and your relationships are threatened. And so there is this like taking on of the pain and the nervous system of the other. And so I got into the perfect relationship for what I learned how to do. So when she was like I knew there was something wrong. Like I wasn't abusing her, yelling at her, controlling her. I mean, I did have my own trauma system of, you know, rigidity and nervous system dysregulation. But I also had a rule where like our family is the only one that we love and you hate everybody else. She had the opposite rule where she felt safe with friends, but not safe with intimacy. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, from the beginning, there's a part of me that's absolutely afraid. I've done something wrong. What are people going to think? How is this going to like play out? What's wrong with me? Like, it was just this underlying, like, badness was the primary. It was the one that was vocalized. It's like, I'm bad. I'm bad. I don't want to be bad. I can't be bad. And trying to fix that badness by trying to calm and regulate her. But that wasn't something that was within my capacity to do.
So what was the final straw?
You know, in the end, I'm trying to think of how to share this. There's layers of vulnerability here, and I'm deciding how deep into my own vulnerability I want to go.
I'm the vulnerability whisperer, just so you know.
So, well, you know what? I'll share this with you. This isn't you'll be the first to hear it. So, in the marriage, I'll say that there are two things. One is, like, I always supported her. Like, early on, she was at a job where that she hated, and I supported her leaving that job, supported her starting to find and create like multiple small businesses, and then getting into a job at a Fortune 500 company. And she was growing and expanding and doing well there. And then internally, like, I'd also left my job after 2 years into the marriage. I worked at a small law firm advising tech startups, and I'd left to start my own company that was working with finance and tech startups and raising money and connecting them to large corporations or to angel investors. And the thing is like that died on the vine. It's hard to talk to people and say, you know, will you give $50,000 when you've just been yelled at for 4 hours every other day? And so that died on the vine, and I wasn't working, and she'd been working for like 3 or 4 years, and she's moving up. And so that's one layer, is she's getting job security and moving up in the job security. And the other layer is there's also some extreme sexual shame that was inside her family. There's a lot of sexual shame coming from my family as well, but there's also zero capacity to talk about it. And that lack of capacity wasn't on my side. Like, unfortunately, every time I tried to have a conversation, that conversation was triggering and went to 4 hours of her screaming. And so in over the years, it went from being a hypersexualized relationship before married to 6 months to a year at a time with like nothing there. And maybe 4 or 5 years into the marriage, I started looking at porn and masturbating, and I'd do that regularly. And then there'd be the random time once a year where she'd like ask for sex, but like, if I've just masturbated earlier in the day, like, I'm not in a space to do that. And so the two things that intertwined at one point was she was getting a promotion and a raise at work, and finally like moving into a place of like safety for herself, where she could feel safe on her own. And there was like one of these points where she asked for sex, and I was like, well, we need to wait a few days. And then the next morning, she walked into the room and was like, I'm leaving. There was like no discussion. It was just like, I'm leaving, I'm walking out. And she like left 30 minutes later. And I thank her for that. You know, she had the strength to do what I didn't have. And I think I'd hit the ground long enough at that point that I could like start to look at me and the things that were inside of me as well, that kept me both like trapped in this, but that deep amount of shame, that deep amount of security, the collapse and absence of my own will, the fact that I spent my entire life in dorsal vagal and sympathetic hypervigilance. I mean, I was devastated. Like, I was actually like in a place of despair and devastation for 8 weeks. But so like in the end, this is something that has like troubled me, because she was the one who finally ended it, rather than me having had that willpower to do it on my own. And yeah, I think that's like it's like a difficult and a hard place, but it also, you know, you have to like, I don't know, I hit that bottom. And I fortunately found Tim Fletcher's program 8 months before and tried to get her and my entire family to do it. And I was at a place at this point where I immediately, like the next day, signed up for Tim Fletcher. I joined CODA, like Codependents Anonymous, because I knew that was a problem. And I just like started hyper fixating on my healing journey and really working on myself at that point.
I'm curious about, because you mentioned the thing about, were you working at a Buddhist retreat center, or what was that? What did you say? You were living there or working there?
Yeah, so I had, you know, so I'd been depressed and not working for a long time, and I was trying to find ways to ease my way back into the world and society. Again, not understanding complex trauma. And so I'd found this job at this Buddhist retreat center in California. And I think this actually, I think, was the beginning of the downfall, because we'd been living in Minnesota. She felt steady and safe there. And by moving to California, it caused like an uneasiness and a disruption in our lives. And so I was there for 3 or 4 months, about 4 months. And then we moved back. And what's ironic is in moving back, we first, like, we landed with my family because we didn't have a place to stay for a while. And so we stayed with like two pieces of my family. But then we could like really, we'd both been seeing psychologists. Like I'd been seeing psychologists like on and off for like 6 years at that point, and she'd seen a few. And so at that point, we could also start to recognize some of the fissures and the rigidity and the internal problems of my own family. But yeah, I think part of that destabilization is something that kind of really
shook things up,
shifted something for both of us. Yeah.
When you were seeing all those psychologists, was there, I'm assuming, like the experience of so many of us, they never bring up that it's complex trauma?
You know, my experience with psychologists were horrible.
Yeah.
The male psychologists very quickly always became them talking stories about themselves. Like I had one guy, the first guy I went to told me that I was a vulnerable individual and that maybe I needed to be taken out of my family. And so that was something that like really hit, but it was also like deeply shameful. And then he immediately, you know, with our next sessions was talking mostly about his daughter's relationship and things. Like it wasn't about me anymore. I had one woman who every time I'd go in, she would say, I may have had like, by laying on the couch, my wife wouldn't get triggered. And so if I was like laying on the couch on YouTube and on Reddit, I was safe. Mm-hmm. And within 6 hours of sitting up and entering the world again, my wife would get triggered. That'd lead to 4 hours. It'd be like exhausting. And then the safe. And so like I, at this point, I would be like, the pattern was I'd spend 2 weeks on the couch. And then my body was just so tired of being on the couch that I'd try to re-enter the world again. And then within 6 hours, my wife would be triggered, would be screaming at me. And so I'd go back to the, but while I was on the couch, she was nice to me. She would often cook for me. She was calm. Like she felt safe with me lying on my back. By doing that, I created safety and calmness in the relationship as well. And there was this one therapist I'd go to, and her first question was always, what did your wife do now? And when you think of the reticular activating system, she wasn't creating gratitude. She wasn't like helping me look inward. It wasn't doing with my own shame. Wasn't helping me get in back to my body. Wasn't helping me get to my feet. But it was literally, what did your wife do? Well, I would leave those sessions feeling worse than I came in. And I like, I understand now, like, you know, sometimes you feel bad after a psychology mm-hmm. session, but it's because you're facing pain and you're facing pain in a healthy way. And you're going in like, this was like, she was traumatizing me. Mm-hmm. And I was like creating safety in my own life by exiting my life. And then this one therapist. And then I had another therapist who like took my wife's side. Like she was a feminist. And so as a man, I'm bad. And obviously my wife was the victim in all of this. There was no like co-equal, no anything. But it was just like I went to this woman for like 3 or 4 times and it was always you know, she was just like
shaming.
Took my wife's side. Yeah. And like, you're doing something wrong. Like you're the problem. And then I had a few others, but like, I'm pretty smart and I've read a lot of psychology books. And so it was really easy. Most of my other therapists loved to intellectualize with me. Like they would just dance with my brain and we'd talk philosophy and psychology, but like avoided talking yep. about any of the real, like avoided talking about me. And so we'd talk about, you know, the nuances of IFS rather than ever actually doing any IFS. And so it was really just, yeah, I probably went to eight or more therapists over a period and none of it was effective. Like most of my, any healing or learning I did on that time, like came from my own learning. And from my own efforts.
So many of them out there who haven't done their own work.
Does anyone really know what hormones do? Like, there's so much talk around women's hormonal health, but most women are left even more confused about what it means for them and what the hell to do about that. So shit shows, let's leave this confusion behind as we head into the holiday season, shall we? Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. And Happy Mammoth, the company that produces Hormone Harmony, is famous for its zero compromise policy. No GMOs, artificial fillers or flavor or any other junk. Only science-backed ingredients in amounts that are clinically proven. So this holiday season, give yourself or the woman in your life the gift of wellness. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That is happymammoth.com, code adultchild for 15% off today. All right, shit shows. Did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common nutritional gaps? It affects 1 in 3 adults, and especially women. It often shows up as fatigue, brain fog, weakness, brittle nails. But the problem is that most people don't realize that low iron may be the cause of these issues. That's why I'm here to tell you about Siderol from Pharma Nutra. This is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while also avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea, constipation, and all that fun stuff. It is clinically proven to be comparable to IV iron and is formulated with just 2 ingredients, iron and vitamin C. It's vegan, allergen-free, gluten-free. You can take it anytime, anywhere. So if you are that 1 out of 3 with an iron deficiency, head to pharmanutra-us.com and use code adultchild for 10% off your first order. That is pharmanutra-us.com, promo code adultchild for 10% off today.
So you start healing, you start working with Tim. I want to kind of like shift into I want to shift into like somatic stuff. What was your body keeping the score?
Yeah, you know, the way I understand it now is, so I look at the nervous system, and 500 million years ago, the dorsal vagal, the dorsal part of the nervous system developed, and that's the collapse. But like people, I want to clarify one thing is, like, most people, we have this like fake dichotomy where many people think sympathetic bad, parasympathetic good. And then when we go more detailed into dorsal, sympathetic, and ventral, people think sympathetic and dorsal bad and ventral good. But that's not really truth in a healthy nerve. Yeah.
Give brief descriptions of each just for those.
Yeah. So the dorsal developed 500 million years ago, and that's the place of stillness and collapse, is what I'll say. And so, you know, early evolutionary fish, your only choice is to play dead. But it's also this capacity for staying still. 400 million years ago, the sympathetic nervous system developed. And the way I say it is, like, teeth developed. And so we developed the ability to move toward and move away. And so the sympathetic is healthy because it allows mobilization and movement, but it also is where fight and flight are stored. So the survival energy of aggression or the fear survival energy of running away and escaping. And so when we say fight, flight, or freeze, you can commonly look at it as, you know, sympathetic is fight and flight, and then the dorsal is freeze or some version of the dorsal and sympathetic. And then 200 million years ago, mammals learned how to love each other, learned how to, like, there's more of a capacity to connect and socialize. And that's when the ventral arm of the nervous system developed. And the ventral is where we feel safety, belonging, connection, welcoming. And so when I look back at my own nervous system, my house wasn't safe. My school wasn't safe. There was zero safe place. The ventral was basically like offline, never allowed to be online. And I began when I was 3 years old, when I was in third grade, when I was 8 years old, and I learned how to read. So the similar thing with my wife, sat on the couch 4 hours every night as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, reading. Because if I was still on the couch reading,
you were safe.
I could escape into fantasy and my dad wouldn't attack me. He wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't make noise. And so that wouldn't trigger his dysregulation. But like, it was never his dysregulation. It was me being the problem, me being a bad boy. And so my nervous system has only ever been in this hypervigilant, sympathetic, must succeed, must do well, must perform, must play this role and be great, as well as like fawn, which is like, oh my gosh, like Andrea, you know, I hope you're doing, you know, how are you doing? Like, you're so lovely. Like, this is going so swell. You're great at everything you do. You're the best. I'm really great in those two, but then also like an extreme amount of dorsal. And so sitting still, like, you know, again, in my childhood, I learned to just sit still and play small and I wouldn't get attacked. So the dorsal, like, it protected me. And then in my marriage, I learned to lay still, stay small, I wouldn't be attacked. And so people, when you go into dorsal, like there's a lot of like, this is also where maybe like dissociation, extreme disconnection from your body, going into fantasy, because fantasy is the only place you can be. And so my nervous system, I've like spent my entire life inside the survival sympathetic and a survival dorsal, and never had that opportunity really to develop that safe, gentle, present, connected. And so it's interesting because like, as we talk about somatic, I focus so much on like reconnecting with my body, like understanding the nervous system adds like this umbrella over what I understand with somatic. Like, I used to joke, and I think a lot of people, like, I was a bodiless head. Like, I'm a great thinker. I'm really smart. I'm lost in thought, but I was completely separated
from your body. Yeah, I was going to ask you, what was your awareness with your body?
Yeah, completely disconnected. So when I was going through the LIFT program, I was also like, I'd had a, you know, I was a voracious reader, OCD, trying to heal myself. And so I think like Peter Levine is the founder of Somatic Experiencing. Mm-hmm. And I read a lot of his books and really started to do body-based exercises to reconnect with my body and to come alive inside my body again. But also to be like, if I move, I dissociate. And so I used to run, but like running was this thing where my body was a machine to make it perfect, to make it like beautiful. So women would love me and people would find me attractive and I could be better than others. And so like, you know, the times I was in my body and my life were always from a place of disconnection, dissociation, and using my body as a tool rather than being connected to it and caring for it. And so I really began with like a lot of different practices to first to kind of like move into my body and be safe sitting, but then also to move in my body and to be safe
moving
while my body's moving instead of going into that dorsal collapse, the dorsal shutdown, and just like checking out. And that's one of the things that I work with a lot of people is like many people are the West values heads and thinking and not emotions and bodies. And so there's a large degree that many people in society are disconnected from the emotions and disconnected from the body. And so there's these pathways to move back into connecting. And what I'd say too with that is like, there's a very smart reason that we disconnect from our bodies. Mm-hmm. And so when we first start to connect with them, we start to face the pain that's stored in them, the torment that's been there and never been allowed to process. And so it really sucks. It's a really sucky journey to begin to connect to your body because it's all of these things that we've been able to hide from and avoid that we find hidden in plain sight. And so, you know, there's two layers. One is becoming connected to it, but another changing your relationship with it, changing it around it.
When it comes to somatic healing, and I'm curious like how you would break it down, but I think that there's several things. I mean, the first thing that is required, becoming aware of your body, right? And so what did that look like? Like, what were some practices and some tools for you to actually feel feel your body, be connected to it, be aware of it.
You know, the two first tools that I use and that I offer to people is, one is progressive muscle relaxation. And so all you do, like I love like 30-minute videos of that. Like that's like the right pace. I mean, you could do 10 minutes of it. But what it does is like, so if I squeeze my fist, like this is like a gross sensation. I can feel myself squeezing my fist. And you go through every, you know, part of your body doing that. And then when you release and you let go, there are two things that happen. So right now there's no active pressure there. And so my body is like learning to relax. I'm paying attention to the sensation of relaxation. And so like, you know, complex trauma, we lose the you know, it's complex PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Like our bodies are in this tense state, this stress all the time. And so we don't know how to relax. So this is why I like progressive muscle relaxation. And so I pay attention to this body part relaxing. And I can learn, I start to learn, and I give myself the experience of what it's like to begin to relax. But I also, after letting go, I can feel these like remainder sensations in my hand. And so like I'm starting to rewire my brain connecting to this part of my body. So I can do it with like, you know, tensing my abs. And so like you're doing the tension. So that's like the gross, the physical sensation. And then you let go, you release, you pay attention to the relaxation as your stomach's releasing. Feel what relaxation feels like in this area of your body and feels how it feels like for you. But then you can still feel these physical sensations here. And so this is my favorite way, especially for people who are like extremely dissociated, to get, because it has both of that reconnecting the feeling, but also the reconnecting the relaxation. And it's one of these things where like you have to do it for 30 minutes a day for 30 days kind of deal. You've got to do it pretty often to reconnect, to rewire. The other one that I really like, it's a weird one. I do this in classes sometimes. This comes from Peter Levine, but you go through your whole body again and you kind of like tap. So you have that gross, that physical sensation. And maybe you could offer yourself some form of an affirmation while you're tapping of like, oh, this is my head. You know, I can feel my skull. It's protecting my brain. You know, or like my legs are made for running and jumping. This is protecting this. And so you tap for like 15 seconds or you rub to a degree. And then when you stop, you feel those sensations afterwards. And this is too, where like you do maybe three, you know, a 3-inch area at a time, or you can do like I can do it in 10 minutes and do the whole body, or I can do it in 40 minutes and do 3 inches at a time. And this really, it's a weird one. Sometimes like when you do it for a while and you feel safe in your body like really becomes more awake with this. Like I feel high sometimes after I do this, because it's like awakened and alive into my body, but in a safe way. And so you like feeling good in your body. And this is something that like some people right away can connect to that feeling good in their body. Not everybody, but I've like definitely had people report that right away. And so you go through body part by body part.
Does that have a name?
And I don't remember. It comes from Peter Levine, and I just call it Peter Levine's tapping exercise. A lot of my pure somatic stuff comes from
him.
Either directly from Peter Levine or things that I modify based off of what I know about you or what I know about the group that I'm leading at the time.
Obviously the progressive relaxation works for both, but do you think that there needs to be, like, how would you modify if you are working for somebody whose norm is more that perpetual numb versus somebody who is in more so that chronic tension, hypervigilance?
So numb meaning more in like a dorsal state?
Yes,
versus
connected.
You know, there's an interesting, like, I look at these, the architecture of the nervous system, I think, guides the direction of the healing with the somatic. And so one layer that I add on to it is, so a lot of times that constant tension is, you know, we're like trapped in a survival sympathetic state. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we need to do is to create safe access to safe sympathetic state. And this is where, if you can be really conscious, maybe doing yoga or Tai Chi or Qigong or calisthenics, but like slow, safe, conscious movements in the body, allowing your body to be safe and allowing your body to be connecting to the healthy version of the sympathetic rather than just being in the activated version of the sympathetic. For people who are in that numb state, you know, a lot of people are like, just meditate. And this is something like, meditation is something that moves you into that healthy parasympathetic. But if you're used to being chronically dysregulated in the sympathetic or collapsing, dissociating into dorsal, you need to build a bridge through healthy sympathetic before you get to that place where mm-hmm. I'm going to sit still. And so like, there's a lot of people like, you sit still and your brain is just like, fuck this. Like the electricity's going and you're flashing off all the place and you're just like restless. And so I don't try to make anybody sit still until they're ready to sit still. Like I want you moving in a slow and a safe way. And that could be like even just, you know, sitting in the chair here in a collapse or shame, like all you, you know, a simple thing is just like raise your heart a little bit, raise your chin a little bit, and allow your eyes to open up and look a little bit more. And that's something that can move you a little bit out of like a shame or a dorsal and more into a stable, grounded, sovereign place. Like a lot of stuff is also, it's just like little nudges sometime and feeling that nudge. What's it like to move from this state to the, and then when you feel that and you can attach to that regularly, that may be something that just starts to come naturally on its own over time.
And so once we have some awareness of our body, we're able to feel it. I would think that there's two things. Like one is learning tools for regulation. And I'm curious too, if people who have more of a tendency to go the numb route, I mean, there's still dysregulation that's happening there, I would imagine, but I'm wondering if it's hard for them to recognize that. But I would think one is tools for regulation, but then also practices to help you build the amount of distress that you can handle in your body, like your window of tolerance. So could you speak to both of that?
Who, you know, I'm thankful for a little monkey for helping me with my own window of tolerance. And I think it's great that you build that up. Like I helped to raise this baby monkey and I'd feed it milk every day. And the little guy Mowgli would crawl all over my face. And then he'd like nibble on my ears and on my nose. And the very first times that he did that, my body was like, oh my God, you know, he's going to break skin. He's going to do this. It's going to hurt me. Something bad. Like my distress tolerance was really low. And then I realized, you know, I was safe. It wasn't dangerous. He was just playing. He loved me. And then I would tell myself, this is like at a pain scale. I slowed down and I was really like, because my brain is immediately like red lights flashing, danger, danger, 10 out of 10, 10 out of 10. And I was able to, like, I wanted to keep hanging out with him. I didn't want to freak out. And so I was able to tell myself, this is a 2 out of 10. This is a 2 out of 10. And so fortunately, over a 4-month period, this monkey biting me gently and lovingly and playfully helped me to, you know, re-regulate some of my own distress tolerance, that happening was no longer a 10 out of 10 danger signal, but it was only really a 2 out of 10. And that's something that, and with many things for a while, you like go into cold water, you get that shock. Like, this is not a 10 out of 10 danger situation. This is a 2 out of 10 danger situation. And it's something where I like consciously reminded myself over months to tell myself, like, this isn't, you know, something's happening. I'm not denying that something's happening, but that's, you know, my limbs aren't being ripped off. I'm not being, you know, I'm not bled out right now. I don't have somebody pointing a gun out at me. I'm not at a 10 out of 10 danger system. My nervous system is reacting to old fear. And so that, like, building that distress tolerance, that window of tolerance is so important.
It's funny when you're saying that, like I'm thinking about how I have like the opposite problem where with my cats, I mean, if they're on my lap and they're like kneading, like, I mean, I just will let them do it. And I end up with just scratches all over my body.
Yeah, that's something that 5 years ago would have freaked me out, because any movement, any touch was essentially like a danger signal. That's why it's smart to dissociate, smart to be outside of your body. Because when I was a kid, touch meant danger. And yeah, to be able to be at the place where you can enjoy that relationship with the cat and allow a 1 out of 10 happen to you. You know, your body's taking
like
a hurts. 1 out of 10.
Like, I shouldn't let him do it.
Or like some degree, but the hit points, you know, it hasn't severed an artery. You know, you haven't lost a leg from your cat, like kneading on your lap. And so you don't need to hit the cat or throw it away or be extremely afraid. Like, you can stay in relationship with that cat and not worry about what's happening.
What about go-to practices for you when you do notice that you're dysregulated?
You know, so my dysregulation, like, again, I come from this hyper, this is why I like you, is because I think there's, you and I come from like different sides here in some areas. Like, I come from extreme inhibited, extremely overregulated, extremely overcontrolled, so kind of like shutting down to be safe. And so, you know, sometimes like it's just even, you know, in that moment, all you need to do is like lift a finger slowly, because this is like, I'm no longer completely in collapse. Like, I can, as I do this, what's funny is I can still connect to like my stomach is tensing. I have tension in my head, just kind of like thinking about a situation where I'd be in collapse and just doing this calmly and slowly. And so for me, it's about, I'd say there's two things. One is safe movement and curious movement. And so a lot of my practices for collapse are just some sense of slow, safe, curious movement coming out of that door into a healthy sympathetic. And I'm not even worried about getting to the ventral at that state. Like, the ventral will come by being slow and safe and my sympathetic.
What do you mean by curious movement?
Yeah. So what I'd say, one of the other things that I offer to people right away, especially when they're reconnecting to their bodies, there's this tool I love. It's called somatic tracking. And it's essentially, it's almost like a guided meditation where you spend 5, 10, or 15 minutes and you sit in your body and you explore the sensations in your body, not with concepts or words. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, my chest is freezing, I'm scared. It's like, there's like, I feel tensing, I feel coldness, I feel this. And so you explore the feeling, but you really try to embody, I like to say, as like a toddler. I love to use children, and especially if people have children, their children as, you know, their mini guru for how to heal. But like, you know, if you could imagine a toddler exploring a room, they're looking at color, they're feeling texture, they're tasting things. The sounds are coming into their ears and they're just curious and interested with what's happening. And so somatic tracking is this practice where you begin, you know, my relationship with my body is like there's this electrical storm going off all the time. And I'm like lashed to a peak against my will. And, you know, the wind is battering me, the hail is hitting me, there's like thunder striking all around me. And I'm just like terrified and frightened. And so if I can look at that inner torment as a fireworks show, a toddler, oh, whoa. Ooh. There's a big one. Oh yeah. And like the color, the sparkle, the pop. And so this is one of the things, like, so as we go into our body and you're facing the pain, I always give somatic tracking as well, because we want to change it. You know, it's like, oh, I hate that. Oh, I hate that tension. I'm tired of this, like, you know, this tension in my jaw or this like feeling in my chest. Like, oh, I just, you know, instead of like fighting it or resisting it, we're learning to soften around it. We're learning to relax around it. And I don't need to tell you to welcome it. You know, welcoming is where we get to, but we get to that welcoming by becoming curious about it. And so if it's a splashy fireworks show instead of a dangerous electrical storm, like we're just trying to change our relationship with the sensations themselves.
Yeah, one thing that I think is interesting is just for so long, I viewed this as not being able to handle the thoughts in my head or my emotions, but realizing how much of those, the emotions, the thoughts are really in response to the sensations that I'm feeling in my body.
Yeah. You know, I love like the way Deb Dana talks about this. Is like she really says, like, state precedes story. Mm. And so these, you know, if there's like racing thoughts in your head, it's because your nervous system is at this, you know, this dysregulated sympathetic state. And so that dysregulated sympathetic state, our brain is so smart that it starts to create a story to say why we're suffering. Yeah. And again, the body keeps the score. We're at that dysregulated state because our body's been trained to go there, and it's protecting us by being there and keeping us in that worry. And so, yeah, a lot of those thoughts are, but one of the other tools that I really love, it's like, it's called cognitive defusion. And so it's like really separating your thoughts from, you know, realizing that your thoughts aren't reality. I can think about tomorrow, and that feels like tomorrow feels real, but it doesn't exist right now. I can think about this fictional place called Arkansas, but it's not real. I'm in Minnesota. Arkansas is not real in my environment right now. And so we can be reacting to our stories, but we can like disconnect from the stories when we realize that it's not necessarily true and start to separate ourselves from that.
So I'm curious, you know, you mentioned before we officially started recording that you had like, you feel like for the past 6 months, there's been a significant shift. It sounds like quieting the noise in your head. Can you attribute that to anything?
Yeah. So what I'd say is like, you know, the healing journey is never something to look at on a day by day or a week by week. But over the last 3 years, I can generally see every 4 months, it's like I step up a rung on a ladder, like something changes. My body's recognizing my ability to have boundaries, having safer people around me. And the last 6 months has been weird because I've had this like accelerated pace of healing, like things feel weird and unfamiliar. And one of the things that I've been doing, so like I was talking to you with, yeah, early somatic is that getting into your body and having that healthy relationship, that healthy attitude to it. What I've been doing is I've been working on what I call aggression mobilization. And really this aggression mobilization is having my own assertive will, my own assertive force. And so like I go straight into freeze and fawn because I wasn't allowed to move my body. I wasn't allowed to fight back. I had to collapse. And there's this weird, our society has like a relationship with the word aggression. But like if you and I are standing at a place and you punch me, my choices are to collapse, run away, or fight back. And then, you know, but if I can't,
or tell me, oh, I love the way you punch.
Or tell me I love the way you punch. And so like we to have our ability to have full access to our healthy sympathetic, we need access to aggression. Mm. Like to banter. To have this relationship where you can banter that involves like a pushing out and a coming back and a pushing out and a coming back. And to be able to have that assertive force, that power to do it is, it's like really necessary. And so I've been doing a lot of modified exercises that I'd say would be somewhere between kind of like a Qigong, like a real gentle, slow moving martial art. With more of like a karate, where you're like, you're moving and you're also like vocalizing, but you're doing it in a, sometimes a slow and sometimes a fast pace, but a very conscious and being consciously aware of my core, of my back, but also like creating space, you know, to be able to just push you away and say no, to be able to feel that in our body somatically allows us, like, it then inhabits us in a way that it can be expressed emotionally and verbally as well. And so, you know, if you're like, Andy, come over and wash my car, you know, fawning Andy is like, okay, I have to do that.
I love washing cars.
So, yeah, it's such a great idea. Like, oh, it's really dirty. Oh, more work for me. I'm so happy I can please you. You know, but to be able to have this somatic feeling of the assertive force of no. Like, now I can say, no, Andrea, I'm not interested in washing your car today. Maybe next weekend. And so it's something that has, it's really for me directly working with that collapse and that please appease to give me this centered groundedness, but also, you know, my own force was turned against me by my father and by my wife. And so being alive and a force in my body was something that dysregulated them. Them being around alive people dysregulated them, and I internalized that and I took that on myself. And so a part of these practices are for me to reawaken and realive and kind of my core and my strength and this grounded force. And I've been doing two other things that have been huge for me. One, I call it non-demand work. And in the non-demand work is, so like, I'm a performer, I'm a perfectionist, I'm an achiever. I'll wash your car and I'll have a plan for doing it and I'll be great at it. But there's this constant part of my sympathetic activation is like, do, 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 did you do this right? Do this right, do this right. And my, like, the key of my non-demand work is simply the phrase, I don't have to like you. You know, I have this, like, I'm supposed to like you. I'm supposed to be nice to you. But if I don't have to like you, then I can be in a relationship. It doesn't mean I dislike you, but it means maybe I didn't like what you did and I can say that. You know, it opens up this, you know, I don't have to be perfect right now. My big one that I really like, Minnesota got cold a month ago. And so walking outside, like, you know, again, I was taught a lot of fear and, you know, got to bundle up in the cold. And it was just, I don't have to like the cold. And by not having to like the cold, it just turns the cold into sensation in my body. And so it's not something that I have to walk really fast away from. It's not something I have to dislike. It's not something I have to complain about. But by not having to like the cold, I can, like, see the sun glimmer on the snow. I can see the squirrel in the tree. I can appreciate what's around me as well as the sensations that are alive in my body. And so I've done a lot of non-demand work. And then the third or fourth, I'm doing a lot of things. But the other one that's been huge for me is I've been grieving.
And
I've gone through periods, like, after going through the LIFT program, I grieved my father. Like, I grieved, you know, as a child, as a living, precious being. We have this right to be born into a home where we're loved, where we're cared for, where we're accepted, where we're valued, where our parents appreciate our smells and our noises and our voices. So what a lot of people don't realize is you know, I spent my entire life wanting to be loved by my father, and I have the same relationship with my brother as well. This always, this sense of longing, this sense of loss, there's just this, like, deep loneliness and this deep desire for connection from people who have zero capacity to connect. And so by grieving my father who's living, by grieving a loving father, a playful father, a father who can look at me with kindness, I'm able to begin to accept him for who he is and what he is and start to move to a place of mostly acceptance, but also some forgiveness, and to recognize the trauma that's kept him at this distance, this deep lack of disconnection, because I can feel that, because a lot of what he had, he shit inside of me. Like, that became a part of me and the way I relate with the world as well. And so I've gone through grieving periods. I did my father first, and then maybe a year ago, I really started to grieve my mom. because she's much more hidden. Her shame was like being hidden. And that's something that was like deep inside of me. So I told that woman who excused the abuser every time he was abusing and claimed he was a righteous man on a pedestal to like that. There's like a really insidious form of gaslighting there. Mm-hmm. But it's also unclear because it's always done in this nurturing voice. It's like, you know, here's how I show people what love feels like. It's like, Andrea, you know, you look so great today. You'd just look better if you had different earrings on, right? So, but I'm talking to you in a kind voice. I'm talking to you in a gentle voice. It sounds nurturing. I only want the best for you, Andrea. I only want the best, what's best for you. But that's very different from it's like, you know, Andrea, you have permission to show up today as you are, who you are, who you, like what you are, where you are, as you are. Like you get to be you and I'll be here with you no matter what. And a lot of us get love in the first way, which really empties us out, makes us insecure and hollows us in a way. And so, but that's, it's hard to see when I'm talking, you know, our society really likes that, you know, I just have your best interest at heart, Andrea. When I talk about your face or your body or your earrings or your job or whatever, I just want you to be better. And so
I just want what's best for you.
I just want what's best for you. And so like, so I grieved my mom a year ago. And one of the things that's like changing right now is so like I'm facilitating Tim's program and I facilitate like five different groups. And so I've created it in a way where I've now gone through the program five times myself. Like every day I have a different group, but I'm going through an order. And one group, we just hit grief again. And Tim talks about 42 types of losses. So there's like the losses we know. There's like, he has like four different, I can't even tell you them all right now, but there's like four or five categories of losses. And there's a direct one of like death, you know, even moving, changing jobs. And there's like these different categories. And one of his is there's these 42 types of losses that we may have experienced in our life or our childhood. And so there's loss of safety, loss of connection, loss of acceptance. And like a good student, I remember when I went through the program first, I have like matched like 37 out of 42 of them. And so what I've been doing is I've been going through and I've been spending an hour to an hour and a half facing several of these individually. And so what's really weird about that, what's really unique with the grieving process is by touching to some like deep childhood and marital memories. Like I'll look at the, like the loss of connection for one and like their inability to connect, like going into that, allowing myself to connect to it, to feel the pain, to cry, but then come out of the other end of it. Like with each one of them, I go through this process and I end with an integration statement. And with loss of connection, what was really interesting is that my integration was this tolerance for aloneness. This capacity for aloneness. And so it's like, I'm not, you know, I love being connected to you and in relationship with you. But if I'm like reaching out, trying to take connection from you, there's like, there's this loss, this lack in that. And I can now like, I feel it in a different way where I can embody it as aloneness. Mm-hmm. And I can be alone with you, but that also allows you to be you. I don't need you to be nice to me. I don't need you to be a certain role to me. I can allow you to be whoever you are as you show up with me. And the one that was really interesting, I think it was the loss of acceptance. And loss of acceptance, my integration with that really surprised me. But it was essentially, they can have their chaos. I hold my frame. And, you know, for me, again, as a fawner, as obedient, as like moving into that collapse and always just giving and serving and sacrificing to the other, like even if, you know, your chaos could be like good chaos, but I could hold my frame.
What are you trying to
and
say?
And I can participate to the degree I want, but it gives me this really deep sense of stillness and steadiness. And so it's been amazing, but like, I'd say a combo, you know, I've done so many different modalities of healing, but a big part of what's changed in the last few months has been some other embodiment work, but this aggression work, the non-demand work, but then also the grief work, because there's a lot of like this fear and shame and these deep losses that I, you don't really know are losses, but they direct how I act today still. But now I can be alone in other people's chaos. It doesn't need to affect me as much. And it's just something like there's a lot that's happened just this week, and my body has felt weird in a good way, because maybe 5 months ago there was some extreme chaos in my life, and I was still, even after 2 years of healing, that took me a week of like using my tools, going to my supports, finding my connection. And there's some similar chaos that's been happening this week, and I'm just allowed to be myself. I let other people unfold the way they're unfolding. And there's a lot more stableness and steadiness and groundedness. And I get to be okay, mostly okay.
Just a palm tree in the wind.
Just a palm tree in the wind. That's beautiful. Yes.
Is one of the 42 losses the loss of getting to make poop, pee, and fart jokes as a six-year-old boy?
You know, that...
Can we implement that as a practice? I mean, we got to get
a lot of them cross over. But like, I'm sure there may be, I don't know what all the 42 are right now. I'm just looking at them one by one.
We might need a 43rd. We might need a 43rd.
Loss of expression, loss of voice. You know, again, loss of acceptance, loss of unconditional love. Like a lot of them.
What, loss of having fun? Yeah, just like being silly and goofing around. Mm-hmm. Is it hard for you to joke around and play? Like, is like learning how to have fun, has that been a difficult thing for you?
That actually, it is part of it, because, you know, when we talk about banter, like I could make a joke, but if you reply to that joke, my fear modes are going off. And so it's still something where like I'm learning. I've lived my entire life inside different roles and inside a lot of fear. And so being in relationship, like being here with you and responding to you, rather than having to think ahead, rather than having to plan ahead, like it's still something that's unfolding. And so I've been a little serious my entire life, and I'm learning how to be, I don't know, I have a playful side, and I'm excited to explore it more.
Last question would be, I'm curious, so how have the dynamics shifted with your family since you've been healing? And has there been any sort of reactive abuse?
Well, I don't have a family, mm-hmm. is the simplest answer to that. You know, I ask my mom for permission. So my family, when we see somebody who's in trouble, we're afraid of contagion, and so we turn our backs. Mm-hmm. And so me being vulnerable and suffering, that's bad. That triggers them. They don't want to be around that. And there's also like the shame, just the extreme amount of shame and shame over everything. Like if I recognize, again, if something wasn't perfect, it means it's evil and it's bad and we're all going to hell. And so my family has turned their backs on me since my divorce. And I've been non-invited to graduation parties and weddings and Christmases. And, you know, it's interesting, like my mom is the only one who I've had any sort of connection with. She's the only one who has a capacity for connection. Everyone there has a lot of fear, mm-hmm. but like we were taught to fear connection. And a lot of like the endings in the family came from me trying to connect, mm-hmm. trying to repair a relationship is what triggered them to run away. Mm. And so I've had these acts of connection where that act of connection was turned into, I haven't been spoken to in 3 years. And so The good news is that I get to spend more time with people who are capable of connecting, mm-hmm. willing to see me and willing to accept full, messy, real, human, poopy, farty, smelly Andy into their life. And that's also, you know, it was a year ago where I really set a boundary with my mom. And I think that boundary with my mom is what's made things more sane for me. Because my family was playing this weird game where she knew about my life. So they would talk to her and pretend that they were connected mm-hmm. to me. And so they were triangulating, gossiping. And so like the first graduation party I wasn't invited to, I wasn't even told the part about, but they went to mom. She knew I was going to be in a different country, but pretended, you know, he's not going to be back then. So my sister never even reached out to me. But if she'd reached out to me, I would have flown home a week earlier to see my nephew graduate. And so there's this like pretending on both my mom's part. There's these fantasy relationships, this fantasy connection that they could both, like my mom was taking, she was taking the role of me because she knew pieces of my life. And then they would connect with her and pretend that like all of them could pretend that the system was still whole. Mm-hmm. And so I had to set a really strict boundary with my mom and not let her know about my life so that this fantasy break could be seen as real. And I don't know how much I could keep going on. Like, well, I'll stop. That's like, so am I connected to my family? My family, like old Handy, doesn't really have a capacity for connection. And so that answer is no.
Hell no.
No. No.
Give me one thing that people would be surprised to learn about Tim.
You know, the thing that surprised me, I'll give you two, because the thing that surprised me was when I found out he has essentially a photographic memory. Like Tim is the version that people want AI to be. Mm-hmm. Like, he has 30 years of experience of working with people, such deep experience with trauma. He's read so many books. And so if you ask him a little question, he goes 8 levels deep from 8 pathways, and you think you're going to get a 1-minute answer, and he'll give you a 30-minute answer that like shows the entire web of trauma. And there's this like depth and complexity. And so like I have like no memory. We're on the opposite end of the spectrum there. But I think the one thing with him is he is like capable of genuinely loving people. I don't think that's a surprise, but there's like, he'll let you hang out to dry a little bit in a loving way. If that's what you need, he'll nudge you forward into pain if that's what you need. And he just has this way where you feel that you're accepted for the full you, and you get to show up as that full you. And you don't, you know, in our staff meetings, often a facilitator will say, this happened in my group and I did this. And Tim's first answer is always like, you're right. You did a great job. Like it's this immediate dive into like, I've never felt more supported and held by an organization, but that organization, it's really coming out of his heart and his structure. And so it's, he'll support you and then he'll offer you guidance if you need it. But it's just really being seen and validated and accepted. And I'll have to show you one more. He doesn't like to be put on a pedestal. There's a lot of people that, you know, see him as this trauma healing God and complex trauma. People like to pedestalize.
He's like, I'm just another dude.
He is just a dude that likes to go for walks and likes to spend time with his family and likes to spend time alone. And he's a bit of a nerd like me. He likes to study and learn. So.
Well, I appreciate his authenticity because I'm sure as you've seen or maybe have seen, it's just, it's really interesting when you know, when the record button goes on and you see a different version of somebody, you know, it can be quite a turn off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's definitely the same human everywhere he goes. Like he's not performing. He's just a real human being. Yeah. It's been such an honor and a pleasure to work with him.
Yeah.
I'll throw you one more thing, actually. He's really funny because like, you know, when you're a recovering codependent, you know, the whole like me throwing adoration at you and you being super thankful, like I'll give him like a huge compliment and then there's like thanks, and it's just this like there's this grounded reality and how he relates. Still, there isn't that need to massage your ego or make you feel big or important in some way. He makes you feel important because he's just present with himself and present with you.
But no weird quirks, like he has to have cut the crusts off his sandwiches or something weird like that.
You have to ask his family about that. I've heard some of the stories, you know, waking kids up really early at Christmas. His wife isn't a huge fan of that. You know, apparently, I forget one, like Brianna told me, I think he had for a long time, he had this app on his phone that told him when all the big boats were going by on the waterway near where they lived. And so, no, he's just a human being doing some human beingness.
One time I had my hypervigilant ass, I downloaded an app that had all the police blotters, scanners, and I would listen to them. But you would have to have like the code sheet up because they're like, we got a 404B, you know? Yeah. That's where there's my.
Did you ever follow?
Yeah, no. I was just looking for boyfriends. No, I'm kidding. Just looking for potential suitors.
You're going with bail money?
Yeah, exactly. Thankfully that was never my type. Where can people find you, or do you want to be found, or what do you want to share or shill or whatever?
I'm not really shilling anything, you know, so people can mostly find me through Tim Fletcher's work at timfletcher.ca. His LIFT program is wonderful. I'm also the host of the Time with Tim podcast, which is half him and me talking to experts and then half just me talking to people who've been through his program. And if anybody wants to reach out personally, is it safe to give my email address out? You can find me.
I don't know. It's up to you.
I'll give it. Andy Carlson at Outlook.com.
But Andy Carlson at Outlook.com. Awesome. If you got any good pee or poop or fart jokes, send them on over to him, okay?
This is going to be our relationship going forward, is inappropriate jokes that we'll hopefully send back and forth to each other.
So let's see if any of these apply to you, okay? You've done the therapy, you've read the books, but you have yet to dip your toe into the somatic healing pond. You still find yourself having reactions that are out of proportion to the situation at hand. You live in a constant low-grade state of hypervigilance, like you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. Or you're on the opposite end, you're checked out, disconnected, floating through life like your head is a completely separate entity from the rest of your body. You live in chronic tension, your shoulders are up to your ears like mine, or your jaws clenched, hips tight, lower back pain. Or you deal with digestive issues, or you're constantly tired in a way that sleep just doesn't seem to fix. And last but not least, you're craving a place to heal with other cool people where you can just show up as your whole messy self and be accepted for it. So if any of those applied to you, and let's get real, shit shows, at least one of those applied to you, it's time that you sign the hell up or breathe to heal. This 7-week journey kicks off on Tuesday, January 13th. It's led by Teresa, fellow shit show member and somatic and breathwork practitioner. And it combines the three modalities that literally helped me thaw out of functional freeze and start moving my life in the direction I actually wanted. Breath work, somatic practices, and parts work. This is a steal compared to other somatic programs out there with 2 and 3 month payment options to make it more accessible. So yes, you, let's do the damn thing already. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is breathe with an E at the end, adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal to get your damn spot and thank me later.